Andrew shows Morrison how to do a recovery budget. Digital sham contracting is killing people. And the good news is the world is not waiting for us to act on climate change. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your co-host, Ben Davison, and joining me as always is our lovely host, who's looking very summery in her top today. A few flowers, just a lovely smile. Guardian columnist and socialist extraordinaire, Van Badham. How are you, Van?
Thank you, Ben, a person who I intend to marry. Thank you very much. As Ben knows, dear listeners, I am not particularly well, so he is bringing the recovery sunshine.
Well, speaking of recovery, Van, that's...
I know, I slipped it in there, didn't I?
Look at that, perfect segue. It's like you've done this before. Today we want to talk about economic recovery. We want to talk about the Victorian...
Oh, my God, Ben, I love talking about economic recovery, don't you?
Well, I think the Victorian budget is such a beautiful piece of contrast to the Morrison budget that was delivered a few weeks ago that we can't help but be in love with economic discussions today.
Oh, well, to be fair, this is the basis of our relationship. But, yes, the Victorian budget is absolutely extraordinary. It is an old-school Labor recovery budget, the kind of budget that people like you and I and all of our comrades have been agitating for many, many cold neoliberal decades. And here it is, $50 billion worth of it. And it's a corker. It's fantastic.
Let's just touch briefly on some of the big highlights, because I think they are worth mentioning, because then we can compare and contrast them to what came out of the Commonwealth budget and what we're seeing kind of tiptoed around in some of the other parts of the country. So you've got a $5 billion plus investment in social housing. We talked about that last week. People will remember that. That's a huge investment. That's the largest investment by any state, possibly ever. Certainly the largest investment in Australia since Kevin Rudd used the power of the Commonwealth all the way back then. We won't talk about Kevin Rudd too much today, I promise. We've also seen some real federal issues being tackled at a state level. So the 5 days paid sick leave for casual and vulnerable workers. Victoria has no industrial relations system of its own. People in other states may not know this because in some states they still have their own state-based industrial relations commission and awards and some other vestiges of that system. Victoria signed it all over. Jeff Kennett signed it all over to the Commonwealth. So what Andrews is doing is really remarkable, really revolutionary, because of course we've already seen Christian Porter and Scott Morrison come out and attack that, and it's a tax and it's this and that. But of course, it's going to help hundreds of thousands of people who we saw during the pandemic have no choice but to go to work when they're sick because they live paycheck to paycheck.
Well, this is the thing about working casually. One of the great mythologies, and I wrote about this for The Guardian a couple of months ago when this was all starting, when they had that guy down in Tasmania who tested positive for coronavirus but was still going to work. Mm. Well, of course he was still going to work, because if he didn't go to work, he didn't get paid. And the casual conditions do not come with sick leave. And of course the Liberals will say, oh, well, you know, casuals know this. Christian Porter said at the time, yeah, casuals know this, and they know that they've got to save up for a rainy day.
25%. He was suggesting that 25% of a casual's wage should be put aside by them for a rainy day. You know, anyone who's worked casually knows that you're not earning enough to put aside a quarter of what comes in for a potential rainy day. Nobody banks on a pandemic.
And our very good friends at Per Capita, which is another left-wing think tank, they did a report that talked about the fact that the days of casuals being, you know, comparatively paid more than permanent staff for being casual, they're over.
Absolutely.
Like, huge numbers of casuals across all kinds of different industries either get hardly any loading at all, if at all, for working casually. And yet these people are also denied sick leave and various other forms of leave that are supposed to be, that, you know, are part of permanent permanent jobs, but are supposed to be covered by this mythological fantasy loading that Christian Porter insists still exists, when in fact it was the Liberal government that made it possible for all of this loading to be stripped.
And let's not be confused by this either. It's not just Per Capita and left-wing think tanks and unionists and people on the left like Van and I who say this. There are reports by companies like KPMG that break down just how much of a benefit the company gets by shifting their workforce to casual, because now in many industries, casuals are paid less than permanent employees. These reports are on the internet. You can Google them. You can look them up. When I was at the ACTU, we pushed these out into the media and to try to get them into the mainstream consciousness, because it's scandalous. It's actually scandalous. The government's aware of this.
It's outrageous. And of course, Australia has one of the highest rates of casualisation of the workforce in the OECD. We know this. You know, industrial relations changes made by conservative governments have made the workplace very unfriendly to the worker. Mm. And of course, if you're working casually and you're living paycheck to paycheck, obviously your capacity to bargain, you know, we get told by the Liberals all the time that, oh, you've got the freedom to negotiate directly with your employer if you know the conditions you want for your work and be a competitive employer. It's all absolute nonsense.
The freedom to choose poverty.
Yeah, the freedom to choose poverty. It's the freedom to choose exploitation or poverty is not actually freedom to choose. Did you notice how I just did a Milton Friedman reference there, the father of neoliberalism, everybody? So it is extraordinary that Andrews, who is a state premier, has gone, actually, we're going to do this. And it's part of an extremely, because it's not all industries who are getting it, but it is the frontline industries who've borne the most dangers of COVID, which are highly casualised. Things like the privatised sector of aged care, the privatised sector of childcare. And it's building better industrial standards into those jobs that really kept us alive during the pandemic. And of course, what Andrews is doing, and this is a lot of the framework of the Victorian state budget, the reason why it's relevant to people interstate as well, is that it's building conditions into workplaces that encourage competition from the private sector to meet the improved conditions that are particularly being offered to public sector employees. So one of the things that Andrews is doing, which is not happening in other states, very famously in the state of New South Wales, run by Liberals, they've had all these freezes on public sector pay, and, you know, public servants were the ones who had to, you know, feel the pain for the cuts in the pandemic. Well, the reason why conservatives and neoliberals like, I'm trying
cuts
to think.
Cuts to public sector pay.
Cuts to public sector pay. I was trying to think of a verb that didn't include a swear word that Apple may not like for what they do to the public service, is because if you can have good work conditions and good pay and stable conditions and serve your state or your nation in the public service, well, why would you go and work for a private company? If you suppress wages and conditions in the public service, it means that private companies suppress wages and conditions as well. Keeping things suppressed for public servants has a flow-on effect in the economy. Well, Andrews knows this, and as a pro-worker Labor Premier, has gotten rid of pay freezes in the public services part of this budget. The idea being that some actual competition will go back into the system. And if private employers want to get the skilled workers to work for them in Victoria, they will have to raise their game. The idea that we have a government that's actually doing this deliberately, this is stuff from the 1940s, and it is fantastic.
Can I also just add to that, that Morrison tried to make a bit of a hoopla, or his ministers tried to make a bit of a hoopla, that they were removing the pay cap for the Commonwealth government employees as well. Of course, what they did was they removed the 2% cap on pay increases and said it would be anchored to private sector wage growth. And as you've just pointed out, private sector wage growth lags behind public sector wage growth. So if you suddenly say, well, the public sector is going to be following the private sector, you're essentially going to be cutting people's pay. So Morrison kind of tried to do a bit of smoke and mirrors there with people. Of course, the CPSU and the public sector unions just said, this is nonsense. What you're doing is actually trying to cut people's wages and drag wages down across the economy. You know, Stephen Koukoulis, Richard Dennis, Alison Pennington.
These are all economists, by the way.
Yeah, all economists.
The economists we hang out with at parties.
Well, the economists all pointed this out, but of course Morrison just ignores it and reject the premise of your question style. But again, what you've got is you've got a state government who's going there on wages, is taking it up to the Commonwealth, is taking it up to New South Wales, not just on wages, but also on things like cementing in minimum staff to patient ratios in things like aged care in our hospitals. So really lifting the bar, lifting the minimum standards that we as citizens should be expecting, not just in our wages, but also in the services our state provides. And again, Morrison has outsourced aged care, has refused to put in place minimum staff ratios.
Or walked away from the Aged Care Royal Commission, you know.
New South Wales refuses to put in minimum staff ratios in hospitals. We've seen some industrial action there that went to the commission in New South Wales and had to be cancelled because it was deemed to be unlawful or not appropriate by the commission, where nurses had said, we cannot save people. We cannot look after people in these conditions. There are not enough of us to look after people. So they walked off the job demanding more nurses, right? You don't see that in Victoria anymore because we have minimum staff ratios. So this is this kind of budget. And again, that's not the only area. We're seeing it also with climate change as well.
The fact that the Andrews state government, I don't know about the listeners to this show, but I'm on a lot of lists for various like climate action because, you know, I'm a mailing list junkie, Ben. I'm on a lot of lists for organisations that campaign for climate action and various other sort of environmental and justice issues. And I got a wonderful email from our friends at Friends of the Earth yesterday going, oh my God, it's amazing. Like, it was good news. Good news from an environmental organisation? Like, that never happens. And they were saying, you know, there's just so much that's good in this budget. These massive investments in renewable energy. There are going to be renewable energy zones across Victoria. They're doing the, you know, the Biden framework of talking about climate change, of talking about climate action. It's talking about jobs.
Yep.
You know, you say climate, I say jobs. And that's what's happening in Victoria. Victoria is also taking the lead on offshore wind, which is something we could have gotten started in this country decades ago. You know, and it's such a good transition. It's such a good transition industry for us because it's offshore wind is construction. It's heavy industry. It enables, you know, like blue collar professions to be transferred into blue collar jobs in renewables. All these things, and it's actually happening. I mean, this is great too. Like the Victorian budget is talking about 400,000 jobs. Over the next
5 years.
5 years. I mean, and this is just fantastic. It's interesting because, you know, you and I obviously, like, contrary to popular belief, do actually speak to people who vote for the Liberal Party, as confused as their decision makes us. And, of course, we have friends who are small business people who, you know, see the Liberal Party because quite self-consciously promoting themselves as the party of small business. Well, the people who will benefit from these incredible investments in Victoria are small businesses.
Absolutely.
Targeted investment, like out in regional areas where they're building the infrastructure of climate action, renewable energy, creating all these opportunities, you know, pumping money into services and all these things, that creates a market for small businesses. And these are exactly the kind of workers who spend their money, the local cafe, the local restaurant, you know, at the local shops, the local boutique, the local market, all of these things, you know. And Victoria really is the place to be on the basis of this. One thing I want to mention as well, there are some very deliberate measures in the Victorian state budget that address the deficiencies of the federal budget. One of them is this investment in opportunities for retraining and hiring women who are over 45.
Well, I did want to say that, you know, given today is the International Day for the Prevention of Violence Against Women.
It's the beginning of the 16 Days Against Violence, yes.
Yeah. I think it's really important that we mention that while the Morrison budget was widely and properly derided for not mentioning women, for excluding older women who have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, the Victorian government has deliberately stepped in and stepped up to fill that gap, both in terms of providing a subsidy program to get older women back into the workforce, but also free kindergarten, childcare.
Expanded before school care, expanded after school care. I mean, these are life-saving, career-saving, family-saving measures for a lot of people, you know, doing what they call the juggle struggle of managing work and caring responsibilities. You know, in our age group where people are under the most most pressure, generally raising children and dealing with aging parents, and at the most, you know, critical juncture for earning and you know, trying to make an economic go of it, pay off houses, stabilise careers, like finish postgraduate training, things like that. I mean, it's a really difficult period of life.
Yeah.
And the idea that the government is actually going to step in and do what governments exist to do, which is provide services to make life easier for people, it's just such a relief. Like, quite frankly, and there are so many other things. Like, there's money for women-led entrepreneurial businesses, so women can get access to capital to start businesses and become employers. And, like, it's just so exciting. Special initiatives around women in tech and all of this stuff.
And, of course, the Victorian government, as we know, has already committed to family and domestic violence leave for its own employees, and is encouraging businesses. I'm aware that they're encouraging businesses to do the same here in Victoria as well. So this is a really positive, pro-worker, pro-women,
pro-community,
pro-community,
pro-child,
pro-regions budget. It's been sort of very warmly welcomed in the areas and the sectors you would think that it would welcome it. Even most of the business lobby groups have had to kind of go, oh, this isn't actually too bad, because their members are going, hey, we're going to benefit from this. And yet we still see the Murdoch media having a crack at the Andrews government. But we'll put them to one side, because, I mean, this is all very exciting and it's great for Victoria. And I think it does set a really great example and a shining light to much of the rest of the country. I think that we do need to touch on what's going on in New South Wales, because that also has an impact on the rest of the country.
What isn't going on in New South Wales? There are mass koala deaths. I mean, there's the idea that the platypuses may have their habitat destroyed and thrown. And yes, then there's a Gladys Berejiklian's coronavirus test that, you know, she just ignored and went to speak to Houses of Parliament anyway. But that's not actually what we're talking about. The myriad failures of the New South Wales government are, in fact, myriad. But we are going to talk about
the deaths that have occurred as a result of digital sham contracting and the silence of the New South Wales government and the Morrison government when it comes to the exploitation of people by large tech companies, large platforms that are engaging in sham contracting. Now, don't get me wrong, not every platform system out there is engaging in sham contracting. And we know that in New South Wales, Unions New South Wales has worked hard with Airtasker, for example, to get to a point where Airtasker is actively trying, at least, to make sure people get the minimum conditions under the award. But we're also seeing people who are working for platforms like Uber Eats dying on the roads to deliver essentially cheap food to people. A man was killed delivering McDonald's on a bike in central Sydney. Now, I know that there's been Michael Caine, who's the National Secretary of the TWU, had an article today in The Guardian. There was a vigil today outside Uber Eats' headquarters in Sydney.
Yes, it was very moving. They all kneeled on the ground.
You know, I think it's atrocious that these platform providers are engaging in digital sham contracting. You know, you would not get away with offering someone a non-negotiable, standardized contract that undercuts their wages, that undercuts their conditions, that provides them no occupational health and safety, no workers' compensation. There's one woman who was flown out from China by one of these platforms to attend her husband's funeral, who's been offered no compensation other than to pay for the funeral. I mean, this is an outrageous abuse of working people. This concept that somehow or another, because it's a digital platform, it's somehow revolutionary, it's a nonsense.
Oh, yeah, well, this is the thing. A lot of the subcontracting that goes on with the digital platforms makes the offer to potential workers that you'll be your own boss. If you're a driver for Deliveroo or Uber Eats or any of those platforms, you are not your own boss. Like, you don't get to determine the conditions of your employment. You can't negotiate subcontracting fees. That's not how this works.
And if you turn them down for a job, if you say, no, I'm not going to do that job because I'm doing something else, they can suspend you from the platform.
Which they do.
All the time.
All the time. I mean, we know that the platforms absolve themselves of responsibility for things that go wrong. We know that they absolve themselves of responsibility for the kind of training that keeps you alive on a Sydney road. The idea that, for example, I know one of there have been issues with the exploitation specifically of international students.
Yes.
And we know why this happened, because all of these people got stranded in Australia for the pandemic and weren't provided any income support. So they have gone to whoever was willing to pay them anything in order to stay alive. And these are people who are not provided with the kind of level of training that keeps people industrially safe. The idea that you would be a person from another country who doesn't have the niche knowledge of traffic conditions in a city like Sydney, which is like where I am originally from, which is a nightmare of a place to get around, particularly if you don't know it, you know, put under enormous amounts of pressure to meet deadlines and, you know, keep the favour of the platform and the rest of it. Like it's unbelievably dangerous. Of course, 5 people have died.
Yeah.
I'm surprised more people haven't died.
Well, that's only in the last couple of months. That's in the last couple of months. Let me make sure people understand that. That's not 5 in the last 5 years. That's 5 in the last couple of months. So, look, that's obviously a terrible example, but these platforms exist outside of Sydney as well. Of course they do. They exist in Melbourne. People use them in Melbourne. I know people who have used these platforms. We don't use these platforms.
We don't use these platforms, and we're really full on about that because they are exploitative. And at the end of the day, saving 25 cents on a taco is not worth the blood of a working person.
Absolutely. Like... And, of course, they're in Brisbane and I think Adelaide and Perth as well. So, I mean, the first thing I would say to people is...
Don't use them.
Don't use them. The second thing I would say is support these workers, help them, join your union, because the unionisation of your workplace gives power and strength to their fight to unionise, to their fight to get the rights that they need to be safe, to be properly remunerated and to be treated with the dignity and respect that we all deserve in our workplace. So all power to those workers who are standing up, and a big shout out to the TWU and the other unions.
And the TWU have been fantastic. They're really fighting for these people. But, you know, as with all of sham contract, and we saw this a few years ago when there was that unbelievable report on Four Corners about exploitation in the food industry, about people who are on guest worker visas who are being absolutely milked for every dollar, working in unbearable conditions. Sometimes it's actually really difficult for the unions to find them because the, you know, the sham contractor goes to some trouble to keep them isolated, to keep them decollectivised, to keep them separate. They exploit language barriers in order to keep people disempowered. And this is what, when Ben is saying, you know, support your union, because when you have a strong and activist union, because it has members in density, they have the resources to go out and find these people. And that exposition in the farm industry happened because the union, which was the NUW at the time, is now amalgamated and is the UWU. They had an activist membership base who helped them find these people and represent them and organise them and demand their rights and bring all of these abuses to light.
And what we've seen as a result of that, of course, the NUW, United Voice, United Workers Union, the CFMEU as well, took up this issue in construction, where we had people on visas who were being basically loaded into houses. So you'd have 12, 15 people living in a three-bedroom home, the contractor taking a cut of their wage, essentially, by charging them $400 a week to live there, the contractor charging them to load them in a van every day to take them to a 12-hour shift on a work site.
All under the threat of them losing their visas and being deported.
And of course, it would be remiss of us not to say also that women who were trapped in these circumstances were also sexually assaulted and harassed. And what we saw, again, you know, God, I'm such a proud Victorian. Victoria led the way thanks to the work of these unions, thanks to the work of the union movement, thanks to the bravery and courage of these workers, and licensed labour hire and licensed those industries so that it became very, very hard, much, much harder to exploit workers.
We saw those reforms in Queensland as well.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it makes all the difference, like it really does. But they come from union campaigns in order to stand up for working people.
So it's absolutely possible. People sometimes go, oh, they're big tech and they're global and what do? We can't do it. People make decisions, you know, people make the decisions. So if you decide it's not acceptable, there'll be other people who want to make that decision too. So stand up, be part of the change, and
stop ordering Uber Eats.
Stop ordering Uber Eats, people.
Walk down the road and buy it from the takeaway.
So,
I'm sorry to be a bit pious, but this stuff really bothers me. And as Ben knows, like one of my bugbears is that a lot of people who consider themselves very progressive,
yep.
who think they're quite like progressive and full on and live in the inner city, like we've heard these people, we don't yeah. associate with these people, but we've heard these people, you know, talking about, oh, how great, yeah, Uber, oh, yeah, how great, like, you know, Uber Eats, oh, just get a Deliveroo, oh, kind of thing. And yet they represent the worst kind of exploitative labour practices.
Absolutely.
They're not ethical.
And one of the things that sometimes gets thrown out there is, oh, well, you know, taxi drivers are not well looked after either, right? And that's very true. That's very true. And I don't want for a moment for people to think that we're saying don't use Uber and use taxis because taxis are better employers. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that there are slightly better labour practices in taxis. They are more regulated. There are more avenues for taxi drivers to get their rights and to be safe. But not only that, you don't say, oh, well, I'm happy for this form of exploitation to occur because it makes it cheaper for me. But that one over there is a bit more expensive. Like, let's address the issue of the exploitation in those industries. You know, delivery driving, taxi driving. We're seeing far too many people, and somebody wrote an article about it today where he actually said, and it's quite a shock for people, particularly white people, to face up to this, that what we're seeing with platforms and exploitation in services is white people finding servants again. You know, and when you look at the fact that the people who have died delivering food are people of colour delivering things like McDonald's to white people, it's hard to argue that that's not the case. So if you are a progressive person, a left-wing person, a person who says they value workers' rights, then you've got to live that. You've got to put those things away. Delete the app, you know. If you've used it before, we're not out to condemn you. We're saying, here's the facts. Like, if you weren't aware before, you're aware now. You can't excuse this any longer. And join your union so we can make the systemic change.
Mm.
Let's make those systemic changes.
And it's also like looking at the bracket creep. As Ben knows, one of the many reasons why I have issues with the Greens is Nick McKim, who's a Green senator from Tasmania, in his maiden speech got up and delivered, and you can look this up on Hansard, I'm not making this up, delivered this paean to Uber and how great Uber was because it cut down paper waste, and did this big speech about how, you know, oh, this is the sharing economy and we should expand platforms to things like labour hire and childcare, and all with this was the quote, the lightest possible regulatory touch from government. And I was just horrified, like beyond horrified, because actually when it comes to working people, we want government to absolutely regulate it, because deregulation leads to accidents, exploitation, underpayment, and five times in the last couple of months, death.
I want to very quickly, before we wrap up on this topic, I also want to say that there is, as you say, that kind of bracket creep or that industry creep. It's also happening in the NDIS.
Oh, yeah.
So there are platform providers in the NDIS. I think there's about six of them. Five of them use this digital sham contracting model. And I'm deliberately calling it that because, you know,
You are not your own boss.
You are not your own boss. Nobody in those five platforms is getting employed or conditions or proper wages or health and safety. The platforms themselves take no responsibility for the reporting that you would expect in the NDIS as well. So there are, in my view, there are clients being put at risk as well as workers being put at risk. I think it's really potentially very dangerous. There is a platform provider in the NDIS space who I will name, called HireUp, who do employ their people. You know, and I've seen union reports to some of the inquiries, the parliamentary inquiries on the NDIS and the creep of platforms into this, that say, well, you can have a platform and have labour standards and hire people and actually use the platform for all of the user and client interface that people like and all the stuff that people want to be able to instantly access and get that kind of experience and that kind of service. But you can also do that without having sham contracting. So I would just say to people, by all means, use a platform, use digital technology. Nobody here is a Luddite, but make sure that if you're using it, that those people are actually properly employed. They've got occupational health and safety.
Award wages. Union coverage.
And if they're not getting those things, then you really need to rethink what you're doing. Because frankly, if you're part of the exploitation of working people, you can't really hold yourself up as a left-wing progressive. You just can't do it. All right.
Gosh, that got dark.
It did get a bit dark, but like I said, there is hope in there. There is the work that Unions New South Wales has done with their tasker. I'm not saying it's perfect. There is higher up in the NDIS space who's showing that there's a different model. So there is hope. There is hope. And again, it's people who make decisions, right? So make the decision. Don't use the bad ones. Use the good ones and join your union and support the regulation of these industries in a proper way. We should have some good news, though, don't you think?
I've got some good news.
I think the world is ready to hear it.
Some of my good news is that the Biden administration, to be the Biden administration elect, have already started making senior cabinet appointments in their very strange system,
yep,
where you don't have to get elected to be appointed, which is the weird Americans. But they've appointed our friend John Kerry.
John Kerry,
the presidential candidate in 2004, who went on to become Obama's second Secretary of State. The former
who denied me my chicken dinner in Paris.
Who denied Ben a chicken dinner in Paris when the place we wanted to go to get chicken, we couldn't go to because there was a security presence because there'd been a terrorist emergency and John Kerry was in that restaurant that night and Ben has never gotten over it.
I'll never forgive the man.
I forgive John Kerry because he's a climate envoy and Biden has given him special status as a member of the cabinet to work literally representing America's climate action interests internationally. And this is such great news because, as we know, Trump walked away from the Paris Agreement.
Yep.
And this was a guy who didn't even turn up to occupy the chicken restaurant that you wanted to go to. A man of terrible taste as well as absolutely unforgivable bad government. But it shows that the Biden administration is taking climate really seriously and willing to show and deploy American leadership towards climate action, which is great. But the other news that I find really exciting is that China has announced they've created a budget electric car, which is amazing news because having spent some time in China and giving the advice before I went, which was when the pedestrian lights say red, that doesn't mean stop. It says think about stopping. So, you know, basically you're taking your own life in your hands. Having some very intense relationships with heavy traffic in China, the idea that China, they have got a car, this was reported in Mashable today, an electric vehicle down to $8,000, which is amazing. I am quite sure that there are probably massive labour exploitation issues going on there, given the state of China not being a democracy that allows free and fair trade unionism and negotiation of wages. But it certainly shows that in terms of material and production, these things are possible. Mm. Like building a budget electric car is really doable. The other news about electric cars this
week... But you wouldn't get a combustion engine car in Australia for $8,000. You'd be lucky if you could find the cheapest car on the market at $16,000 in Australia. So the idea that you could get an electric vehicle at that price, because we'd want to have proper labour standards, is huge. It's
absolutely massive.
Game changer.
One of the reasons why Australians don't buy electric cars is not because they lack grunt or are somehow unmanly. It's because they're expensive.
Yeah.
And bringing down the production cost of an electric vehicle is an absolute game changer. In a country like China, the idea idea that they would sub out combustion engine cars with like budget electric cars is phenomenal. Like that will make an enormous difference. It may not make the roads any safer, but it'll make them a lot cleaner. But in England, yes. And you were remarking on this week.
Yes. Well, Boris Johnson, who frequent listeners to this show will know, I'm no huge fan of.
He really is a terrible person. Terrible human.
But it turns out if you're a terrible person, everyone knows you're a terrible person, then they'll go, oh, well, at least we know he's terrible. Weird thing to do. But what he has done that isn't terrible is said that in the UK by 2030,
In 10 years,
they will not be allowed to sell petrol or diesel vehicles. Everything will be electric.
Yep, they're making a full transition. And it's amazing. And Australia could have done this.
Yep.
We could have done this. We have the industrial capacity. We have generations of people who are trained in making cars. Obviously, when the Liberals decided that they would withdraw all support from Holden and literally leave hundreds of thousands of Australians who worked either in the car industry or around it out to dry, which happened in 2013, like there was a spare industrial capacity there that we could have made that transition. It's still possible to bring back that kind of manufacturing. It's been really encouraging to hear Anthony Albanese talking about we want to make things here. Well, if China has worked out how to make a low-cost electric vehicle, we could do that here as well.
Absolutely.
And we know that the international car market is changing. If a country like England is preparing to transition into fully electric vehicles by 2030, like these are things are not going to be the same. And all of Scott Morrison's sort of, oh yeah, bit of grunt, you know, burn some petrol kind of nonsense.
Which was total nonsense and based on a lie, by the way. If you want to look those things up, you can Google the fact that electric vehicles have all the same levels of torque as petrol engines. In fact, some of the fastest cars, most powerful cars in the world are electric now. So, you know.
Oh yeah, you just ask a car reviewer what kind of car they'd prefer to drive.
Yeah.
And I'm big shout out to my friend Peter Anderson here, who's my favourite car reviewer, who's like, you know, the high-end electric vehicles are extraordinary. But, you know, these are opportunities. And Australia needs budget cars as well, because we know what's been tanking over the past few years has been new car sales.
Absolutely.
Because while wages are not going up, families can't afford them.
That's right. And Van, am I right in remembering that the Queensland government has talked about putting electric charging stations up the coastline as well?
Queensland have built the longest piece of electric vehicle superhighway, definitely in Australia, potentially in the world, has been one of their investments.
So let's just put that kind of, you know, objection to bed straight away. This infrastructure can be built. I know that it at the sort of strip mall across the road from Stocklands, used to be Wenderee Village in Ballarat. I'm telling my age here now. They have electric car charging stations. Wenderee, that part of Ballarat is not a very affluent part of Ballarat, but let me tell you, there are cars that get charged up there. This is infrastructure that can be built. It can be built all the way up the coast of Queensland. It can be built in our suburbs, in our regional towns. You know, let's do this. Let's have a clean energy solution for our transport.
South Australia, are you listening? I mean, you had a car industry. You had all of those jobs part of the car industry. We just need a bit of leadership from the federal government and the South Australian government, you know, affordable electric vehicles. These are jobs and climate action opportunities for Australia. Why wouldn't we take them?
Absolutely. That is the end of the week on Wednesday.
Oh, thank God for that. Before I need to retire to my fainting couch, I really am not well.
I want to thank you, Van, because I know you haven't been well, and it's really so important, I think, to the listeners to hear your views on these things. Nobody tunes in just to hear me.
Such a smoothie. He is a smoothie, this man.
Remember to share the episode. Share it on your social media. So share it on Facebook. Share it on Twitter. Share it on Instagram. You know, if you're listening on Spotify, there's your Instagram share. Please do share it. Please do talk to your friends, colleagues, co-workers. Shout out to Ross Kenner, who I know had some conversations with the McCain's workers in Ballarat and got some people listening there. So I hope you comrades at the McCain's in Ballarat have enjoyed this episode.
And also a shout out to our listeners in North Sydney, in the northern suburbs of Sydney.
That's right.
Who we were like, I'm sure nobody from there listens to our show, and wrote to us going, as it happens, we do. And I was so touched. I was like, that's fantastic.
So thank you once again for listening to The Week on Wednesday. We will be with you again next week. We are going to end up taking a break over Christmas, I think, just because we will need some rest.
My mother's coming for 3 weeks and it could get very hairy. Hi, Mum!
But we will be back again next week. So until then, love you, Vanny.
I love you too, darling.
Bye.
Bye.